Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Cultural Studies podcast. My name is Toby Miller, and my guest today is
Kerry Foxwell Norton from Griffith University, Australia.
Well, thanks very much, Prof, for being with us. It's greatly appreciated. You've got an impressive array of books and tchotchkes and whatnot behind you there, which actually looks real, unlike some backgrounds, for example, mine. I wanted to begin by asking if you would share with us what's currently preoccupying, retarding, dynamizing, interesting you?
That would be the Great Barrier Reef, actually. The Great Barrier Reef is experiencing its sixth mass coral bleaching in as many years, and I'm absolutely preoccupied and passionate and motivated by what's happening on the Great Barrier Reef and what that means for Australians and for the world, actually.
Could you tell us a little bit, I mean, probably a lot of the audience will know this, but maybe not all, about the reef and about coral bleaching? Sorry to be very basic here.
No, that's fine. I mean, we'll get to the reason why I want to talk about the Great Barrier Reef and what it has to do with cultural studies and communication and culture, as I would have it. Mass coral bleachings are the result of climate changes, of increases in ocean temperatures. If you can think, and I'm just trying to stay in my lane here, I'm conscious that a lot of misinformation happens around climate change and environmental issues by people not staying in their lanes. But I do know this, that if you can think about reefs, not only in Australia but all over the world, their temperature in the same way you might think about your body's temperature and how sick you become with only a slight increase in your body's temperature, so is also true for reefs. So a very slight and certainly sustained increase in waters leads to devastating consequences for the reef. And of course, with increasing ocean temperatures and other associated outcomes like ocean acidification, the reef and its beautiful corals and my fish friends are under extraordinary stress and facing a very, to say the least, uncertain future.
And the Great Barrier Reef, what is it and what's special about it?
I mean, the temptation is to give you the usual, you know, runs along the Australian east coast around 2,300 kilometres of the coast. The Great Barrier Reef is situated. It's the reef itself, and it's also the catchments that they're a part of that reef ecosystem. Extraordinary biodiversity. The only thing that we, the only ecosystem we can see from space, $6 billion to the Australian economy, in many ways the harbinger of ecological collapse associated with climate change. So that's what I guess that's in part what my research isn't about. It's really about disrupting that way of understanding the reef as only a site for science, you know, industry and politics, particularly science and industry, and the way in which science and industry voices are the way in which we communicate the Great Barrier Reef, and in that form, what we miss out on, whose voices aren't heard, and with what consequences for the reef. I mean, there's a certain amount of hubris involved in the Great Barrier Reef and reporting of the Great Barrier Reef at the moment that says that humans can kill the largest, you know, ecosystem on the planet. What I'm looking for is an inversion of that idea, that in the demise of the reef, we are seeing actually our own human demise. Rather than us worrying so much about the fish and corals, the signal is for humans and their death rather than the death of the Great Barrier Reef. It's a lot, isn't it? But that's what I think about all the time. And it's particularly on my mind because of the mass coral bleaching on the Great Barrier Reef and the recently, today actually announced, bleaching coral reefs all over the world.
And can you mentioned that you wanted to talk about this in terms of communication and culture. Perhaps you could elaborate a wee bit on that.
I could indeed. I guess in terms of the reef being communicated in terms of science and industry, there's an obvious, probably for many of your listeners, connection there with like industrial capitalism and the impacts of industrialized processes on the Great Barrier Reef and how that's communicated. So that that culture of late capitalism and what it means for how we understand environments and ecologies and ecosystems is evident in the way we communicate the reef. So it's not a, I'm interested in the way in which social thinking will impact how we understand and communicate the reef, and therefore the ways in which we might think about possibilities and opportunities to change the current sort of apocalyptic narrative surrounding the Great Barrier Reef and reefs all over the world.
So you're not in disagreement with the apocalyptic narrative, but you want it to become, we want it to be superseded as a consequence of transformation. Have I got that right?
Yeah, I suppose, as I mentioned earlier, it's the idea that it's what the apocalypse looks like. I guess it's what the reef signals in terms of humanity, rather than what the reef's current condition signals in terms of fish and corals. And the capacity, and I guess communication and culture, if we if all communication is cultural and all culture communicates, then it's important to understand what cultural frameworks we're bringing to bear upon the Great Barrier Reef in its communication, and therefore what are the assumptions. Because so far it's been science and industry, and with all due respect to my scientific colleagues who do wonderful science work, all of that science thinking and all of that knowledge that has been generated through obscene amounts of money spent on the Great Barrier Reef by successive Australian governments has led us to here. And so the Great Barrier Reef, successive mass coral bleachings from which it cannot recover. It needs 10 years to recover between coral bleaching. The clear issue is global warming or global boiling, and all that scientific thinking has not been enough to, I guess, to protect the Great Barrier Reef.
And so, am I also right in thinking, and this would be, I guess, controversial, that you're calling for a more anthropocentric approach, one that threatens people with the idea that not only is this precious natural entity being destroyed, but that it's, to use your word, it's a harbinger of what will happen to them?
It's an interesting tension, and it's been something that I've been thinking about a lot in the last, particularly in the last month, as I work towards a book and other publications. The question for me is, how can we solve anthropogenic climate change when all our responses are so anthropocentric? So in some ways, I want to draw attention to the fact that our responses are anthropocentric, and then to destabilize, disrupt by pointing to things that I'm still learning about, around ideas surrounding, for example, for a start, the failure of anthropocentric views very much grounded in science and political economy and industry to protect our natural environments, including the Great Barrier Reef is the case study I'm really working on, but this can apply to any, large valued ecosystem or to, your local pond, same, same. So I guess I'm trying to draw attention to the fact that our responses are anthropocentric and that we have to reconsider the way in which we communicate the relationships between culture and nature, between humans and these ecosystems in ways that might enable us both to flourish, and a failure to consider that in all its complexity will ultimately mean the demise of humans and not necessarily the Great Barrier Reef, which will, you know, which I assume go on to live another day in some way, shape or form, as a good geologist will tell us. You know, so I think it's disrupting what is really, I think, urgent and complex work around bringing social thinking to climate and ecological crises. Enough already with the science thinking. If I see one more news article in Australia that tells me about mass coral bleaching, about temperatures and science, my head will explode. That's really important science communication, really important, but it doesn't tell the story of humans and the Great Barrier Reef. It doesn't bring that social thinking, what that means for humans. For example, the communities that border the Great Barrier Reef who are impacted by its demise in terms of their livelihoods, in terms of their communities, in terms of where they live and how they spend their lives. I mean, there's much more going on here around the Great Barrier Reef and mass coral bleaching than any degree will suggest.
Prof,
it's a lot. I'm pretty passionate about it at the moment.
Sorry. No, of course, and that's wonderful. Prof, I've got a slight connection problem, so I'm going to turn off my camera for a moment while I sort of get closer to the source of the power that is. But I'm still be here and listening and talking, yeah? And
yep, sure. Do you want me to turn my camera off as well?
No, it's just at my end, as the actress said to the bishop. So just a second. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the extent to which this is an Australian issue. It sounds as though it has to be understood as a global one, but obviously in terms of local communities, it's very much an Australian one. And
yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it does this, the Great Barrier Reef does slip and slide between... it has that temporal and spatial considerations that are a part of the complexity of understanding what's happening around climate change and the Great Barrier Reef and other environmental issues. I think the Great Barrier Reef is an international icon, and, you know, its inclusion in things like the World Heritage List, you know, all the politics that have been about, you know, whether or not the reef will be on the World Heritage in Danger List, the implications for international tourism, put the Great Barrier Reef in the international realm. But locally, as you've suggested, it's also, you know, communities and industries that rely on the Great Barrier Reef, either directly or indirectly through, you know, tourists, especially coming to the reef. So the figure is $6 billion to $6 billion to the Australian economy. So it's worth a lot of money to Australia's economy, but its demise signals something for what happens in Australia locally, but also for the entire globe. Because if the Great Barrier Reef and other reefs, as they are impacted by climate changes, and those ecosystems collapse, then that has implications far beyond the east coast of Australia.
Understood.
Not the least of which is for, you know, your Finding Nemo and your clownfish or your, you know, staghorn coral, which are obviously at the fore of my thinking as well, species, other species.
And when you said you'll go a little crazy, as it were, if you read one more newspaper article with a doom and gloom scientific finding, I'm gathering that's because with all the funding that's gone towards that kind of research, it doesn't seem to have made a difference. Yeah. So what would make a difference?
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, it's difficult working in a space where you're trying to straddle the humanities, arts and social sciences and your STEM, you know, your science STEM disciplines. So I'm really cautious about being respectful about the contributions of science and technology in the reef space. You know, I don't want to come off as somebody who thinks it hasn't made a difference. Of course it has. But the sort of difference that that needs to be made now is in the social and the political and the cultural. It's understanding, you know, the historical context and drivers that have led us to treat the reef in such a way that has led to its collapse. So I think that and funding accrues to the science, you know, in a way that marginalizes and lessens the impacts of the humanities, arts, and social sciences, and our capacity to be a part of, you know, solving this problem. You know, we're like the wacky sideshow, you know, whereas, you know, because we don't deal in degrees and temperatures, you know, because we haven't got a number, it's such a recurring theme throughout the, you know, throughout over time, of course, that this sort of positivist, post-positivist, you know, it's still the same thing, that science thinking will lead us to a, that science has the answers. And at this point in time, it's very clear that science needs our help. And I'm about creating opportunities and wherever I can, places where the stories that the humanities, arts, and social sciences would tell about the Great Barrier Reef can be told. I don't get funding for it, mind you, but the, you know, the ultimate for me would be to, you know, to find it as a place where the, you know, the federal government would fund humanities, arts, and social sciences as serious research to be made that will make a contribution to the management and care of the Great Barrier Reef. Currently, that's not the case. The only time that the Australian government, in terms of Great Barrier Reef funding, funds the sort of work that we do in the humanities, arts, and social sciences is, you know, behavioural psychology. You know, how do we get people to behave in the way we want them to, and why aren't they? You know, how are they responding to policy that we have in place, economics, and of course, traditional owners, work around traditional owners, which is, you know, entirely legit, but it was premised on the fact that traditional owners have culture, and nobody else does, and. So I'd like to. It's a bit like in funding for the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. It's a bit like if we were to send, you know, the biologists and the geomorphologists out to the reef and say, "Tell us what you think," and leave all the other scientists on shore. I think that there's a greater opportunity for us to broaden what humanities are, the humanities, arts, and social sciences can offer in terms of the Great Barrier Reef and other environmental and climate crises. And this is just a little, my work is an effort to do that at the Great Barrier Reef, and there'll be other work that's trying to do that elsewhere.
Could you tell us a little bit about your work on this? Because that would help, I think, to colour in, as it were, this notion of the communication, culture, arts, humanities, social sciences, aporia. So you're doing it without the federal funding that you need, but what is it? And what could it be were you to receive that kind of funding?
Well, I might. I mean, I'll begin with saying that the book I'm writing with Claire Conquez at UTAS is called "Communicating the Great Barrier Reef: Media, Politics, and Ecology," and is about the way in which the interrelatedness in a broad definition of ecology is communicated. About and on the Great Barrier Reef. So, and what happens in sort of that global and local media sphere around the Great Barrier Reef and the politics of the way it's communicated. I'm thinking about that quote from John Dewey, which is really the one that underpins a lot of my work. And, you know, I'll paraphrase it here terribly, no doubt. but it's about the society being caused to exist. There's more than a verbal link between the words common, community, and communication, and that when we communicate about something, we cause it to exist. So how are we communicating about the Great Barrier Reef that's causing it to exist? And so understand the Great Barrier Reef as created, not obviously not literally, but as created in communication. It's a part of those communicative relationships between nature and culture, which has that definite that element of communication as a concept, as an approach, but also the acknowledgement of a global media landscape where communication is power. So that's one project. And the other project that I'm working on the reef is, and that lets me, that project there lets me look at communication from various standpoints, whether it be news media and content analysis about the way things are reported, whether it be looking at science communication and how that's reported and how that's received. And well, we've done some work around that also. Of course, visual communication, political economy of communication of the Great Barrier Reef. It's just an interesting site from which to explore how that idea of communication and the communication landscape performs around the Great Barrier Reef. The other project on the Great Barrier Reef that I'm passionate about is called Women of the Great Barrier Reef, Untold Stories of Conservation. And I work on that project with Deb Anderson at Monash. And so that sees the reef as a gendered place. So when the reef is communicated in the voices, largely through the voices of science and industry, and politics, and their arenas where women have struggled for entry and authority, that has meant that their voices are absent, largely absent from the stories we tell of the Great Barrier Reef. And as somebody who understands Australia, you understand how important, these big natures are for Australians and our sense of identity. So it matters that women's voices are not heard in these spaces. So that's bringing a gender lens to environmental communication through the Great Barrier Reef, but it's also an effort to correct the historical record to include women's voices and achievements for the reason of because their stories are actually spectacular and they're wonderful stories. But also it's about rates of domestic violence in Australia. If we're communicating about something so important as the Great Barrier Reef and we're giving voice to women's experiences, then that is a contribution to building respect and for expertise and authority for Australian women. And also it's about women's participation in climate change decision making at a moment when climate change decision making is obviously at the fore of governments of all level and so relevant. Yeah.
In
And
terms of
urgent.
media coverage or perhaps incarnation, what are some of the trends that you see in gender terms when it comes to environmental issues in Australia?
I think that there have been some clear efforts to encourage women's participation in the STEM disciplines. So that makes a difference to how, women's participation in STEM. And I guess I would still say that the key scientific figures that report on the reef or are known for the reef are men. But I'd need to take a closer look at that anecdotally. At the moment, I would say that I'm thinking about, there's wonderful people like Professor Emma Johnson, who is at the fore of reef research. There's a Professor Pat Hutchings, who's just who and many others who I could mention, Helene Marsh up at JCU, Betty Willis, and many other women who are at the fore of reef research. their reporting in media is something that we'd need to take a closer look at.
And what about the people who deny climate change? You're in a situation where the print media in Australia, as I understand it, is essentially owned by the idiotic but cunning Murdoch family, which also has control of a rogue cable news station. What's the story in terms of these denialists? Are they significant when it comes to the Great Barrier Reef or no?
I'm actually involved in a national climate action survey. So what I know is what everyone we all it's very apparent that News Corp have not been have absolutely stymied action on climate change in Australia in their reporting in there, and they still give significant audiences to people who really don't deserve to have a voice around climate change, given the urgency with which scientists are calling for action. In my opinion, irresponsible, terribly irresponsible. So, what I do know is that Australians generally, like, there's a small, very small percentage of Australians who are deniers and skeptics. Maybe 7% of the are nationally represented. This is from the survey, but the issue is not skeptics and deniers. And putting aside the fact that some of those skeptics and deniers will often be older men in powerful positions who vote conservatively. Every time, that's what they look like. But it's the urgency around climate change that is missing in the Australian public. So most Australians, around well over 70%, believe climate change. But what they don't, where they part with scientists is in the urgency of action. So there's this huge gap between Australians saying, "Yes, I believe in climate change," and a couple of extreme weather events that we've had over the last few years are helpful in building that confidence in climate science and concern about climate changes. But the issue is really around the sense of urgency of action, and given current cost of living crisis and housing crisis, it's difficult, and wars. It's difficult to make climate and climate action a priority in at the ballot box and in people's lives. It's easy in the aftermath of a significant flood. That's the time to have those conversations. But the floodwaters recede, and a war takes off, or there's something else happens, or you find yourself without money. I entirely understand why Australians prioritise other things in their lives other than the climate crisis. And I guess our job as researchers and academics is to shift that, because as we know, there is no social system without an ecosystem.
So basically, what you're saying is that the climate denialists are a very small minority. And although they occupy a lot of space in the bourgeois media, they're actually not very influential. Have I got that right?
That would depend on where you locate influence.
So there may
If
be,
if
sorry, go ahead.
if you if you're locating influence in donations to major political parties, in investment, in lobbying, sure. But just generally within the Australian public, it would seem that those efforts to build a nation of climate deniers and skeptics are failing. And that people believe in climate change in Australia. Not that "believe" is a word that scientists like, because it makes it sound like a religion. It's not, but for us. But there are the urgency surrounding action is where we part ways with science.
Got it.
And
That's interesting. And
yeah.
can I ask about your experience of teaching this work?
Look, I've been very fortunate. I've had opportunities to take students to on a climate change communication in the South Pacific study tour for 2 weeks to Vanuatu, because we are, even though we look to the northern hemisphere, we are down here in the south, and our neighbours are actually these Pacific islands. So that was an effort to make sure that our students were aware of, the experience of climate changes in our hood, as it were, which are particularly significant for those Pacific Island nations that live a low material lifestyle, and are on islands where, sea levels are rising, increasing severity of cyclones, frequency, coral reefs dying for me might mean that, my next trip out to the reef won't be particularly as colourful as it once was. But coral reefs attract fish in Pacific Island nations, and that provides protein to communities. So there's this these other extraordinary impacts for people who live a low material life that aren't mine. So the point of that study tour is to introduce students to that idea and what's happening in our neighbourhood, so that they might better report that and communicate that and understand that. And I also teach an intensive on environmental and climate change communication to second year students, which is a week of diving deep into environment and climate change communication, and looking at some key examples which around fires, bushfires, and the Great Barrier Reef, of course, a little bit of my own work in there, and then thinking about the way in which the creative arts is responding in terms of communicating environmental and climate change issues.
And I have two more questions for you, if I may, Prof. And then I'd like to throw it to you to add anything you wish to what we've discussed. It might be what we've already touched on, it might be something we actually haven't mentioned yet. Does that sound okay as a way of concluding?
Sure.
Oh, great. So my first question is to ask if you could tell us what are these contributions from the arts to an understanding of the reef and other environmental questions.
The creative arts, the potential of the creative arts.
What they've done or what they might do.
Communication is really difficult science. Communicating with the public is really complicated science, and so much of reef communication has relied on the one-way transmission models of communication. Here's the science, the mass coral bleaching, as though that's going to be received by audiences, and that will the brilliance of that knowledge will be enough to motivate them to motivate a public or a community to act. And that is recurrent, and it is dominant. So I see the creative arts, or even just creatively thinking, as they have always done, finding different ways to present. It's everything we do is based on the science, of course. We wouldn't know that. We know this is happening because of the science, but the science isn't what necessarily will communicate the need for action. So I see the creative arts in all their glories of, sculpture is probably one of my favourites, because we have a large public sculpture festival here nearby called Swell, where environmental and climate change issues are a part of a public art event that attracts, over 100,000 people, and has people look at what are magnificent and beautiful sculptures, and encourages, and they're told what these things are about, and encourages them to think differently. And so the way in which the message is received is not the blunt instrument of science communication, but rather, in a way that relies on, in engaging with people's creativity, in the beauty, in an aesthetic, as a way to communicate climate issues. Of course, there's other things like, film and art in all its forms, poetry, all of those things. I think that we need that, and that's probably, I know we're talking about the creative arts, but the creative arts in terms of the humanities, arts, and social sciences, that's the breadth of disciplines that that should be supported, I think, better to enable to encourage the sorts of necessary responses to the Great Barrier Reef and its crisis, and by extension, other environmental and climate challenges that we face. I just think that there's, and I don't know the answers to all that, Toby. Like, there's people who are wonderful and who, and I've seen their work, and I've, whether it be either, traditional academic scholarship, or whether it be something that's non-traditional and, creative. But giving those disciplines and that skill, and that expertise entry into these spaces is something we haven't tried for a very long time, to give it, authority. And so, as we fast run out of other options, I think that there's many brilliant people in Australia and all over the world ready to step into that space if they feel that their work is going to be supported. I know that sounds a bit, trite, but that's really what I'm, and I say that because I, I'm not, I say that and I correct myself, because nobody corrects themselves for repeating, the temperatures of marine temperatures, or other important science that's related to the reef. It does feel a bit, it doesn't have the exact of that, but nor are communities, or nor are humans exact. And I think that encouraging broader participation in the reef and other climate and ecological crises may produce different outcomes, and it's not my job to know exactly what they'll be. But this, that we haven't tried that before, and I'd sure as hell like to see what would happen.
So my last question before handing over to you, Prof. K, is to ask you how you go about finding shit out.
How do I go about finding shit out? Oh, well, on the reef.
Could be the reef, could be related topics.
I mean, I have a wonderful network of people that I've built up over the course of my career now that aren't in academia, but I find kindred. I find kindred in people who, in the creative arts, for example, and who run these public art events, in not-for-profits, and in environmental NGOs, who are my people, who work for government organisations, and so they give me guidance. But I guess from an and they tell me things, about what's happening, what's hot. The moment I had a really long, a wonderful conversation with somebody who's at the fore of, organising press conferences around the reef, from a climate perspective this afternoon. So I get lots of information and advice from them. And I guess academically, my whole career has been about thinking about the relationships between culture and nature, and that has led me down many rabbit holes. I still feel somewhat of a novice, because it is so. The breadth and the richness and the diversity, and the way in which minds from all over the world, including First Nations people, have thought about that, is a source of my constant awe, and interest. And it'll keep me interested, for many years to come.
Wonderful. So to conclude, I wonder if there are things you'd like to add to what we've discussed.
Look, I think, how do you think I've gone? Is that all right? Has it
That
been
was
interesting? Have
great.
you been bored? I've haven't been bored.
I wouldn't be asking you to say some more if I thought what you'd said already was dull.
I guess my words would be, I often find myself on the margins in conversations around the reef, around where I'm dealing with, people who have the authority in the room. I live the observations of my research every day. I've been in situations recently where I work closely with people, scientists who had no idea I did work on the reef and announced to an entire room of people whilst I was sitting there that, this fella did work on the reef. So, a bit of a dose of the women of the reef for me. I sort of become my own project. But I think that I'm happy to be on the margins, even though it's really difficult sometimes and I feel really isolated and frustrated that so much of the humanities, arts, and social sciences, my own work, but others' work as well, can also isn't appreciated or given its true worth in these conversations and discussions. I'd rather be keep knocking at the door and keep on, trying to find some cracks where I might let a little bit of the light in. And if every now and again, and I'd encourage others to do that the same and to find kindred around, especially around climate and environmental issues when most days are sad days, and to find solace in knowing that there's other people all over the world who are singing from the same songbook, and it's an effort, and it's extraordinary privilege.
Well,
That's
good privilege to speak to you. Thank you so much, Prof. Foxwell Norton. It's been terrific.
Thanks, Toby. I hope some of that made sense. Goodness me, it's very difficult to on. God. Anyway,
Thank
that's
you
some of
so
what
much.
I'm. Thanks, Toby.